Welcome back to another episode of the Ask Investor Podcast. In each episode, we host a Q&A with another fascinating investor here on QuidRoom, the social network where private investors collaborate with one another and with global investment experts through closed-door virtual community rooms. Each episode is recorded live at a room full of investors, and the conversation continues after the recording. So if your interest is piqued after today's episode, you're never too late to join the community at quidroom.com to get your questions in. Now kick back, relax, and enjoy today's episode.
Welcome, everyone. I'm the founder of QuidRoom, the social platform where professional investors globally find each other. Before we kickstart, just as a quick disclaimer, the content shared in here is for information purposes only and should not be construed as legal, investment, tax, financial, or other advice. Now, for all the investors who are listening into the session and the podcast, if any of your questions are unanswered or to attend future investor sessions live, you can join my community with more than 250 professional investors in QuidRoom. The invitation link is posted in here. Today, we have Elizabeth McCluskey, an active investor into early stage fintech companies in America that are led by underrepresented founders. Hi, Elizabeth. How are you doing?
Hi, Pravin. It's great to be here.
So, Elizabeth, when I was going through your profile, it's noticeable that you didn't start your career as an impact investor. You were working with UBS. And that makes me think, what was that moment in your life that you got interested into this space, that you told yourself that, hey, I want to be an impact investor someday, and I want to support underrepresented founders?
Yeah, so it was a personal kind of epiphany. I was working for UBS in wealth management and then another independent firm called Hightower during the financial crisis back in 2008 to 2010. And so first of all, I saw kind of the vulnerability of Americans to our financial systems and how traditional financial systems weren't necessarily working for everybody. But then so that was kind of a broader realization of how can we make sort of investment in capitalism work to the benefit of everybody sort of more powerfully. Mm-hmm. But my personal story was that I was actually also helping to manage my grandmother's very small nest egg that was supporting her in her retirement. She was a widow. She didn't have a lot of financial experience on her own. And we were investing on behalf of our clients in a tobacco company. But she had been a lifelong smoker who had quit, but ultimately had gotten lung cancer and, you know, suffered a lot of health consequences because of that. So I really kind of had this reckoning between my personal values and what I wanted to do on behalf of not just my grandmother, but kind of any friends and family who I was supporting or giving investment advice to. And then what we were doing, you know, from a strategic and profit-oriented perspective. And I thought there has to be sort of a segment of investments that can make you returns and also do good for the world and sort of, you know, have positive impact versus negative impact. So that was really kind of what led me on the path towards impact investing. I didn't actually know what impact investing was when I first had those thoughts, but I went back to business school to try to figure out how I could integrate impact into my career and discovered that there was this whole kind of emerging field of impact investing, where you're intentionally investing both for profit and for impact.
That's pretty interesting. Now, impact investments, there are an array of things that you can do there. You have personally chose to support the underrepresented founders. In our conversation previously, you did share some numbers that only 2% of venture capital in the US is going to female founders. And from 2015 to 2020, around 2.4% of that went to Black and Latinx founders as well. What are the factors that you strongly believe is the cause of this huge gap in VC funding at this point of time?
Yeah, I think there's a number of factors. I mean, I think one of them, in the venture capital world, there's kind of a concept of pattern recognition and, you know, repeating what works. And so historically, venture capital has been very exclusionary, and venture capitalists have made a lot of money investing in their peers and their friends who have been alumni of, you know, Ivy League schools or Stanford, who have predominantly been white men. So I think one of the first problems of who's getting funding is who is doing the funding. And there's a, you know, kind of equally similar problem of statistics around the diversity of people who are in venture capital. And so the field tends to be dominated by white men. And so then they're investing in white men. So I think that's kind of where the problem starts, which is why there's been an effort both to invest in more diverse founders, but also to diversify who is actually getting into the field of venture capital. Because as you diversify, you know, who's writing the checks and who has this decision-making power, they're going to bring different perspectives and insights and priorities to the table and potentially give a chance to some founders who have gone overlooked previously.
Interesting. And now I want to know a little bit more about this because you're supporting them. And we spoke about the social factor right now. So the social factor side, considering a bit more about returns that can be generated, is there a strong case that can be made for investors to have a portion of their portfolio to exclusively focus on supporting underrepresented founders?
Yeah, there has been a ton of different research that has kind of sliced and diced the data in different ways. So I'm happy to just throw some statistics at the listeners here. There was a study in 2008 done by BCG that found women-founded businesses, for every dollar of investment they raised, they generated 78 cents in revenue, whereas male-founded startups generated 31 cents. So women-founded businesses were yielding two times as much revenue per dollar as those founded by men. And that's actually despite women raising less money than their male counterparts. So they're given less money to start with, but they actually make more out of it. So that's just one, you know, kind of to support investing in gender diversity. Another one from the Ewing Marion Kauffman Foundation found that women-led teams generated a 35% higher return on investment than all male teams. So there's been kind of, you know, consistent research that shows gender diversity can lead to outperformance. Another sort of different way that Morgan Stanley looked at the data was they said, let's look at the sort of demographic representation of women and minorities in the US population. And then let's imagine that they generated kind of revenue equivalent to what their portion of the population would be. There would be $4.4 trillion more kind of gross receipts generated in the economy. So if, you know, if their revenues match their participation in the labor force, the US's gross receipts would increase like two or three fold. So again, there's a missed opportunity of investors to actually support those early stage businesses who don't necessarily get a chance to get off the ground and create significant economic value, both for the economy and then hopefully for the investors as well. And then from a sort of racial and ethnic diversity perspective, McKinsey did a study in 2019 that found companies who were in the top quartile for racial diversity outperformed those in the bottom quartile by 36% in profitability. So again, I mean, I think what this boils down to is having different perspectives, having different motivations, having different life experiences contributes to kind of a more broad thinking sort of mindset of teams. And so those diverse teams are going to outperform those who have all had sort of the same lived experiences and the same approach to solving problems.
That's a very interesting point that you raised there. So that actually brings me to the industry that you're specifically working in, which is financial inclusion. Before I ask my next question, I want to know exactly what we are talking about. Are we talking about financial inclusion focused in the US or across the globe when it comes to what you're investing into?
So for me, the strategy that I'm managing focuses on the domestic US. We're serving US consumers through the companies we invest in.
Okay. So right now, what is a way in which we can do a comparison that currently supporting the underrepresented founders exclusively who are developing financial inclusion companies is going to generate higher returns in, and that is also focused only in US. So let's just deep dive a little bit more around that.
Sure. So, I mean, I think from a qualitative perspective, generally in venture capital, we're looking for founders who are dedicated to the problem that they're solving and who have experience in the problem that they're solving. Mm-hmm. You know, the worst answer you can hear from an entrepreneur in terms of why they started this business is like, oh, I really wanted to start a business and I just kind of came up with this idea. Like, you want somebody who has experienced a problem firsthand, who has lived that either personally or professionally, and says, I am sort of dedicated and motivated to solving this problem, because entrepreneurship is a very challenging journey. And so you need someone who is not just financially motivated, but is intrinsically motivated to solve this problem. There's actually, again, been research that shows people, you know, financial returns are not the strongest motivator of people. It is those intrinsic returns. And so looking for founders who are deeply connected to their problem that they're solving is going to ensure that they're kind of in it for the long haul and they're willing to commit to figuring out how to solve that problem. And so coupling underrepresented founders with financial inclusion is a really sort of intuitive pairing in my mind, because mm-hmm. the populations who are experiencing financial exclusion tend to be women and minorities. So, you know, over 25% of Hispanic households in the US are what we call credit invisible, meaning they have thin or no credit files, which means access to capital for them is significantly more costly than for example, their white peers. There's a wealth gap that's sort of 8x between Black and white Americans today and is actually only growing sort of post-COVID. And primarily households of color who are unbanked and underbanked are paying almost $200 billion in financial product fees and interest versus their peers who are, you know, typically not paying that. So there's definitely a lot of problems that are uniquely experienced by women and people of color related to financial services. And so we think the entrepreneurs who come from those communities who have experienced those problems firsthand are best positioned to solve those problems.
That's a very strong statement. It completely makes sense. And for investors who are listening into the session, how would they be able to access the space and access the potential opportunities that are there right now in financial inclusion in US?
I think there are a number of funds, and I'm happy to provide some sort of follow-up information on funds specifically that are investing in financial inclusion after the call. Mm-hmm. So people could, you know, invest in venture capital funds directly. I also think if people who are listening are angel investors, that's a great opportunity to directly invest in companies that are meaningful to you, that speak to you, where you might be able to add some value or have some connection. Because again, it's that earliest stage of funding that's the most important for underrepresented founders. That's where it sort of really makes the difference of whether they're able to get the business off the ground and generate some of those initial traction metrics to then help them go on to raise institutional funding. So I would say if you have dollars that you want to put to work in underrepresented founders, angel investing is a great way to do that. But if you don't have mm-hmm. the time or sort of the energy to look for individual companies, there's a number of venture capital funds increasingly that are focused on financial inclusion.
And Elizabeth, yourself, at what stage do you usually focus in supporting these founders?
Yeah, the fund that I manage is called the Discovery Fund, which is part mm-hmm. of a broader venture capital strategy called CMF Ventures. We're actually a corporate venture fund. Our parent company is CUNA Mutual Group, which is a financial services and insurance provider to the credit union industry. So the whole ethos and mission of our parent company is around financial health and wellness for the consumers that we're serving through a variety of products. So our strategy kind of dovetails nicely from an investment perspective with our core business. So one part of our fund invests in Series A and later stage companies, but the part of the fund that focuses on underrepresented founders is focused on those pre-seed and seed stage companies. Again, because we think it's so critical to provide that capital at the earliest stages of those companies and really give us a chance to develop a relationship with those founders to help give them some advice and mentorship as they're in some cases learning, you know, the ins and outs of how to fundraise, how to scale their business, how to hire, et cetera. So we think we can add the most value to them at those early stages.
Great. So when you are meeting with these founders that are on the pre-seed and seed stage, what are a few of the factors that you keep in mind before you choose to invest with them?
Yeah. So again, because these companies are so early, so much has to do with the founder. And, you know, do I think the person, again, has experience in the problem that they're solving? You know, what is their motivation for starting this company? One of the things I really look at is what is their receptivity to feedback and how are they sort of as a partner? Because this is not us writing a check and walking away. This is actually starting to build sort of a working relationship where we're, you know, going to try to help add value and give input where we can. So in addition to actually talking to the founder, I regularly like to connect with their existing investors or advisors, or if they have a board, those board members, to get that sort of 360 perspective on what is it like to work with this person. Are they transparent about the issues that they're facing? Because another thing that's sort of a red flag is, you know, entrepreneurs, I think, are by nature optimists. And so oftentimes they're presenting things in their most rosy light. But as investors, especially once we're invested in the company, we're committed to helping you through the good times and the bad. And so, for example, it's helpful for us to know if a company is close to running out of cash. Like, it would have been helpful to know that 6 or 12 months ago, and we could start to formulate a game plan. So hearing from people who have existing relationships with the company, are they transparent? Are they communicative? Are they open to feedback? Are they, you know, sort of a good team player who can attract other talent to the company? Because again, in these early stages, a team might be, you know, 2 or 3 or 4 people. But one of the things you also want to assess about a founder is, are they going to be able to build a really strong team around them? Are they going to be able to delegate and find people who also believe in the mission as passionately as they do, and who can be sort of equally powerful lieutenants to sell and scale that business?
So on the pre-seed and seed stage, I completely agree with you. It becomes a lot more challenging, especially for underrepresented founders to find capital. So it makes complete sense to support them at that stage. I'm very curious to know exactly how is a life cycle after that? Does it become easier after seed stage to raise capital if you have a healthy business? Or is it the same even after?
I mean, I think it's probably still challenging no matter what stage you're at. But I think the more you get into sort of the maturity of the business, the more the business and its metrics can speak for itself. I think what's so difficult about that early stage investment period, again, is it's so much about the founder and you're not necessarily investing on the traction of the business. Once a business starts to generate traction and can show, you know, this is how our revenues have been growing, this is what our kind of path to profitability looks like, here's our unit economics, here's our customer acquisition costs. Like, once you have some of those solid metrics to share, I think it's easier to make an investment case that sort of has nothing, I don't want to say nothing to do with the founder, but like the founder is not the sort of primary factor necessarily at that point. So I think it is still difficult for underrepresented founders, no matter what stage they're in. But I think it's the most challenging at those early stages.
And what do you see is a trend at this point of time in terms of underrepresented founders getting a lot more support? Do you feel that that a lot has already been done, or do you think there is a long way to go?
I definitely think there's increased awareness and conversation around the topic and sort of recognition that the status quo numbers are far too low today. And so we are seeing the emergence either of dedicated funds or new strategies within funds that are focused on underrepresented founders, or a commitment to have a diverse portfolio, even if that's not your exclusive focus. But I think it's still a very long road ahead, and actually some of the progress that women founders had made, you know, over the last couple of years sort of regressed back over the last year. So still a very long road ahead, I think.
Would you have any examples of some women founder-led startups in the financial inclusion space that has made good waves, so that investors who are listening into it can do some comparables of their growth trajectory?
Sure. So one of our portfolio companies is called Climb Credit, and they are led by a woman CEO. Actually, they've had 2 women CEOs in the course of their history, and they're providing affordable financing to students who are pursuing non-degree certificate educational programs. So things like different trucking licenses, some healthcare licenses, they're moving into cosmetology, HVAC services. So things where, you know, there is some credentialing required, there's some sort of training program that takes place to help people get into the field, but it's not where you have to necessarily go to a four-year college to get a degree. So that whole niche of the market has been really underserved from a financing perspective. You can't get federal loans for those types of programs, and private loans are extremely expensive. So Climb Credit works with financing partners. They actually vet and underwrite the programs who are offering these courses, and they only work with schools that have high graduation rates, high job placement rates, high student satisfaction, and can sort of show a demonstrated increase in earnings for students who complete their courses. So Climb does some of that sort of underwriting and verification that these are good programs to partner with. And then they structure the loans to the students in such a way that the program actually only gets some of the principal cost of the program back if and when the student successfully gets placed in a job, starts to earn income. So there's a little bit of kind of a risk sharing between Climb Credit and the organization that's offering the program. But it's really helping create pathways to sort of middle income careers for an entire, you know, like category of people who wouldn't have been able to afford going to those programs if not for some sort of affordable financing opportunity.
So that's a good use case. So I'm just going to ask one more question around it. So since you have invested into them, I want to know exactly what made you invest into them then. I mean, that is definitely the question in my mind. The CEOs, why invest into the CEOs at the pre-seed stage? What gave them the unfair advantage at that point of time that you felt that the company is going to be successful?
So this is actually a company that I invested in my current fund as a result of the relationship I had with them from my previous fund. So we invested in the company in my previous fund at the earlier stage. And by the time we invested in them in this fund, they're a little bit later stage. But I think, again, it speaks to sort of the power of relationship building in venture capital. And one of the biggest pieces of advice I give to entrepreneurs is, even if I say no to you, or if someone says no to you now, ask if you can put that person on your investor update list. Ask if you can check in every few months or so, because there's a number of companies who I've initially said no to who I end up investing in down the line, because I've gotten to see sort of a consistent pattern, both of progress in the business, but also in communication, and sort of organization. So Climb was one that I had invested in previously, but I think because I got to see sort of their track record of growth and got to see the leadership of the company, I felt confident investing in them again and sort of adding more money to the table.
Well, pretty interesting. Now, just one final thing is before we leave for the day, Elizabeth, are there any two words of advice that you can provide to investors who would look very closely into investing into financial inclusion startups in US with a very specific focus on supporting underrepresented founders?
I would say start with where your interest area lies. So, you know, if it's a particular segment of people, like, are you interested in supporting the Hispanic community or the Black community because you have kind of a personal tie to that, I would start there. Or if you know, I think about financial inclusion actually as sort of the pyramid. I sort of use Maslow's hierarchy of needs, but translate that to financial services. So I think of financial inclusion encompasses everything from those day-to-day kind of cash flow needs. You know, do you have a way to budget? Do you have access to a checking account? Moving up to, do you have access to credit that's affordable, that's accessible? But then even going beyond that, I mean, I think you can't survive without some of those sort of basic bottom of the pyramid financial services. But I think it's also important to think about financial inclusion in things like wealth building and legacy planning. Like, are people able to find ways to save for their children's education? Are they able to find ways to save for retirement or for emergencies? And so depending on which of those sort of levels of the pyramid speaks to you, I would start to just do some more in-depth research in that space and start to, you know, kind of do some network mapping and building out your opportunity set in that area. But I think the reason that I love my job and I get so excited to do it every day is because I care about all of these things so deeply. And so I think the best advice to an investor is pick something that's really meaningful to you. It may be within financial inclusion, it may not be, but something that's going to get you excited to learn more and get to know people every day that you're doing it.
Yeah. So returns are not always important. It is important, but then you do need to consider at the end of the day, is this something that you believe in as well? And that completely makes sense. But that's it for now from my end. Elizabeth, you have been a great sport, answered quite a bit of the questions, and the numbers really helped to give me an idea of exactly where the market is. And I'm sure for the listeners as well. So that's it from me for now. Let's make investments better for everyone around the world, one step at a time. For now, let's say goodbye.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Bye.
Thanks for listening to the Ask an Investor podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, then give us a subscribe. And if you're keen to chat with today's guest on this topic, access opportunities in the market, or just want to connect with other investors who are equally as interested in the sector, then join the guest community on QuidRoom using the link in the description. Please note that QuidRoom is only for high net worth investors and investment professionals. No retail investors are allowed. This podcast is for educational and entertainment purposes only. Nothing in this episode should be interpreted as financial advice.